The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Medievalist, now called the Orthodox Nationalist. Today, what we are going to deal with are several facets of the eastern part of the Russian Empire that are worthy of discussion. I have been through several primary sources recently, and by primary sources, I largely mean travel logs written by foreigners, as well as government documents in Russian concerning the economic world of the eastern part of Russia, roughly around the turn of the 20th century. And so we're going to deal with really two general eastern areas. The first one is Siberia, which has a reputation, but the reputation is actually very confused and dualistic, and we'll get to that in a minute. And the other one is really the eastern part of European Russia, which really centers around the province of Sumatra in the southeastern part of Russia. And it should be noted that these two areas are more or less sparsely populated. These two areas are often ignored in your textbook treatments of Russian history or Russian economics. And furthermore, that both areas at least had the reputation before World War I of being havens for dissenters, religious and political dissenters, and as a result have a large number of old believers and other what were at one time anyway considered schismatic Russians from the Orthodox Church. So for those reasons, the economic issues of these areas are important. And I also want to say that it's kind of typical in the literature of old Russia to hold to the view that after the emancipation of the serfs in 1861, that there was a great degree of land shortage. That was felt very heavily in the peasant commune. And I want to say that that's largely mythical, really based on the idea that so much land in southern and eastern Russia had still not been cultivated, and that the government of Tsar Nicholas II paid subsidies for anybody who would move to Siberia and these parts of eastern Russia and till the land. They received tax exemptions, and they received free tools and free transportation. And I want to say that had the Russian Empire survived, I think what would have happened is that a substantial amount of the Russian population was growing very quickly, would have moved to the south and east, and had created a great level of fertility and economic prosperity in these areas that had been just barely touched. So I want to make just really a few points, first of all, on the issue of Siberia. Siberia is an extremely large area. Only parts of it, the extreme northern parts, are under permafrost. It is more or less a fertile area in its central and southern parts. But it still, by the time World War I broke out, only really received a relatively small amount of immigration, regardless of the tax breaks and everything else that the government gave to anybody who would move out there. And of course, the purpose was to relieve the land hunger in the central areas of European Russia. The primary sources and the first-hand really travelogues strongly suggest that the Russians in Siberia, lived uneasily with the native populations. But the Russian population held land in common. There really wasn't any private property that developed in Siberia around the turn of the century. The labor that was necessary to make the land fertile was such that private property was not necessarily the most efficient way of farming. The communal system had really reached an apogee in Siberia, where it was these communal arrangements that distributed land holdings and distributed labor dues. But the Russian population moving to Siberia had a few problems, and the main problem really concerned the natives. The native tribes of Siberia were very peculiar people. The Russians were disgusted really about a few things, and these recur again and again. First of all, the idea that the women of the tribe were the personal private property of the men of the tribe, and that this really is what the old Siberian pagan wedding ceremony really was. It was a transfer of property from the father of the bride to now the husband of the bride. And the Russians who moved out there were disgusted by this, and these marriage customs were one of the many divisions between Russian and native society. Secondly, that it wasn't uncommon in the dead of winter for the natives to choose somebody within the household to kill and then eat. This is something that the Russians slowly learned about. The natives had a tendency to keep this under wraps because they were, in fact, ashamed of it. But it was common, and it shows up in the literature again and again, that these people would murder. It would usually be a woman, and usually be an older woman who had been around and lived a life. Often she would volunteer and say, listen, I'm an old woman, I've been around forever, I've done my damage, kill me and eat me, and then you guys can survive the winter. The Russians never had this problem. So it's almost as if, you know, the natives never quite adapted to the Siberian life. And so these two ideas, the idea of bride property, you know, it really in an extreme sense of the phrase, it existed among the natives. And on the other hand, the institutionalized cannibalism that existed really is something that really bothered the Russian settlers. And there's some indication that those who went back to European Russia went back partially because of disgust of these native, and there were many other smaller, you know, things that the natives were doing that the European Russians could not handle. This is one of the benefits of going through the primary sources, because, you know, you come across these things that don't make it into English language textbooks. So we've already said, as far as Siberia is concerned, that the land is held in common. But I also want to say that there is a great degree of, this is particularly from foreign travelers, continental Europe, traveling through Siberia, they also notice that in all of the communities, whether native or Russian, have no law enforcement and have no law. And yet at the same time, there is no crime, no one locks their doors, and everyone is free to move wherever they want and do whatever they want, and generally there's no trouble. There is no police organization. There is no legal organization in Russian Siberia. And it's something that, you know, these people are living essentially an anarchist communal existence without the slightest problem. The Russians, unlike the natives, are well-fed. They're hardworking. They're motivated. There's no crime. And, you know, this is an area, this is a part of the Russian Empire where a lot of criminals were sent. Now, being sent to Siberia didn't mean much of anything. Oftentimes, there were no prisons, and these people were simply kicked out of European Russia, sent to Siberia, in order to make a living the best way they could. Even when Lenin was kicked out and sent to Siberia, that's when he did his best academic work. It wasn't torture to be sent to Siberia in general. There were prisons, like Dostoevsky talks about in his House of the Dead. But in general, prisoners sent to Siberia simply moved into a local town, you know, an area where there was some population and got a job. So you're not only dealing with, you know, the primary sources say is a crime-free area, but criminals settled there and lived according to the customs of the population, as far as anyone could tell. And in the villages that come under examination from the people who I'm using, most of whom are anonymous, but you know these are travelers who wrote a few things and got back to the Russian government. Russian government agents would travel the area and make notes and things, and is kind of what I'm going by. Are really shocked at the fact that there is simply no crime and there is no legal organization. But I want to make one small caveat to that, and that there is one area of crime that does exist. It's not a public crime, it's a private crime, and that is spousal abuse. This is something that the foreign travelers are really shocked by. This exists both in the native populations as well as the Russian populations. That the beating of one's wife almost seems to be a mark of manhood. This is really the only crime that exists in this part of Russia. Spousal abuse is endemic. It's almost in every household, and no one really wants to theorize about the causes of this. Where, you know, in European Russia, it happens, but it's not all that common. You get to Siberia, it happens constantly. Why is this? The closest that anyone comes to really a theory as to why this is the case in Siberia, is often connected to the fact that in Russian Siberia, as well as American Alaska, there is a very high suicide rate. In fact, in Alaska, if you go to Alaska and you go to the Russian areas, even today, you'll find separate cemeteries, non-consecrated cemeteries, for suicides. And the main reason for that, and a lot of foreign travelers to Siberia have a tendency to stress the idea that because the winter lasts so long and nighttime lasts so long, that you have this great ennui that comes over the population from the end of the summer to the end of the spring, where it for the most part is largely dark. You have this real problem with depression, with feelings of alienation, and this occurs even with these natives, which again is very curious because you would think that these natives who've been living there for centuries would have adapted, but they never do. And the Russians are really in the same boat. Depression, alienation, ennui, alcoholism, and a lot of foreign travelers hold that in the settlements in Siberia, the suicide rate and wife beating are connected. And they're connected due to the sense of depression and oppression that comes from the fact that they hardly ever see the sun. And it's something to be taken very, very seriously. But outside of spousal abuse, very serious crime, of course, there's no punishment for it, although there are certain, you know, social sanctions against it. But since there's really no law enforcement, they do what they want. There's no problems, however, with wives leaving the household or divorcing or moving somewhere else. So it's almost like they consider this perfectly normal. And, you know, if the native males do it, then it's really no big deal if the Russian males do it. And that seems to be really the prejudice amongst Russian women who move out there. And maybe the Russian women themselves fall under this spell of almost constant darkness certain times of the year where they really suffer. And the suicide rate is high, and alcoholism is high, and many people, foreign travelers going through these areas, have a tendency to remark, almost uniformly, that it really is the problem of this constant darkness that torments these people. Amongst the native population, their native paganism remains very powerful. There is no sense where the Russian Orthodoxy is forced on these people. That's never the case. It never happens. You do have voluntary converts, a trickle of them, who come in. And frankly, it's a lot of women who really, you know, reject this whole notion and coming into contact with Russians, that women are not the personal chattels of the males. And therefore they come to the Russians and to the Russian faith as a way to escape that. There is a trickle of converts, both male and female, that come to the Orthodox faith. Unfortunately, the problem with that is that they're shunned by their populations when they get home, and so they end up having to live with the Russians and learn the Russian language, and they become as Russified as anybody else. The pagan shamans that exist in Siberia are very, very powerful. They have very powerful control over their populations. And there's one French woman who traveled in Siberia, and her, some of her notes exist in English, some exist in Russian. She says something very curious. She says that the god that is worshipped by the natives, the name of this chief god is Shaitanya. Shaitanya is just a very slight variation of the Hebrew Satan. She says this many times, and she says that she heard this from shaman leaders within Siberia who have never seen European Russia. Where they get this sense of this, you know, this very common word is Shaitanya, which is just a very close cognate of Satan. That's very curious, and we don't hear much about it. We just get this sense that this is a chief god, and I find this very curious. The clergy, the Russian clergy, find this very curious. So it is a curious a notion. No real cause is given for this. She also comments that really October and November are the two worst months for the darkness, because that's when the nights are longest, which in where she visited in Siberia is pretty much 24 hours. And one of the great sources of wealth in Siberia, and you have a lot of well-to-do people there, you have a lot of you have a lot of very trade merchant oriented people in Siberia, and as is very ancient in Russia, the great products are furs and honey and as well as bear skins. And I should mention that other than Shaitanya, the great god or one of the great gods of the natives is the bear itself. The bear is venerated by the natives, and slowly but surely this veneration of the bear kind of even leaks into the Russian immigrant population in Siberia. And it's taken really seriously. The bears are seen as that creature that can completely adapt itself and live healthy and live long lives and live, you know, happily in the Siberian wilderness, while of course the humans, including the natives, are really struggling to do that. So the bear is one of the venerable gods of the pagan native population. The other animal that is venerated by these people also is the reindeer. The reindeer is centrally important in Siberia, both for food and transport. Generally the Orthodox Church forbids the eating of any animal that has a paw. That would include dogs and cats. It would also include the bear. So the bear was also never eaten for really, you know, ritual reasons by the Russians, really religious reasons by the natives. The reindeer was killed for food, but and that also goes for the natives as well. But at the same time, the reindeer was venerated as another one of these Siberian animals that has been able to adapt. Much lesser is the Siberian snow rabbit, the white rabbit, which of course is not eaten by the Russians because it also has a paw. But is on occasion eaten by the natives. Several travelogues in Siberia, the turn of the century, say that one, and this actually goes back to our previous, you know, topic of wife beating. If there's a vice in Siberia, it is alcoholism. And this is something that the Russians have imported into Siberia. I need to make one thing plain. Russian government had, to a great extent, monopolized completely the sale and production of vodka in Russia. The Russian government, at the urging of the Synod of Bishops, took over this highly lucrative trade with the understanding that they were going to discourage it. And the taverns and alcohol producers who were legal, you always had bathtub, you know, vodka floating around, but in general, the state controlled everything. They were not permitted to advertise, and they were, in fact, obligated to talk about the harm that excessive vodka can cause to the individual, to the family, and to the community. So contrary to what you might hear, the Russian government took over, many years earlier, the production of vodka with the understanding that eventually they were going to wean the Russian population off of that particular vice. It also should be noted that in terms of the per capita consumption of alcohol, the British and the Germans are far ahead of the Russians in terms of that measure. Russians get this reputation of being drunkards, when in fact they drink far less than the Western Europeans. There is one distinction though, that the Russian, particularly the Russian male, is a public drunk. The Western European and the Northern European is a private drunk. And that's why the Russians get a bad rap and the Germans kind of get away with it. Because the German male gets drunk in private, the Russian male gets drunk in public, and just can't wait to proclaim it to the world that he's wasted, and that's one of the reasons that the Russians get this bad rap, and it's something that comes up quite a bit. And when you read a lot of the firsthand accounts of Siberian life, you get this same concept: the Russian male is drunk, you know, so often. And I think that the wife-beating criminality comes from this as well as the ennui that comes from the darkness. I think it's all very closely connected. Because a lot of these people are kind of inaccessible, it takes a long time to get there. There really hasn't been the sociological research on these connections that it deserves. And in America, the Alaskan problem is very similar, where you have severe problems with alcoholism, abuse of all kinds, depression and suicide in, you know, the northern parts of the state where, you know, it's dark most of the time. And that really has an impact on how people live. One of the significant aspects of Russian life in Siberia is the nature of medicine. In general, the Russian who lives in Siberia for some time comes to the conclusion that raw fish and fish oil are really a cure-all. Fish oil is taken to treat depression. It's taken to coat the stomach for heavy drinkers. And, you know, in America, of course, where a lot of us, including myself, are taking large amounts of the omega fatty acids, really for a lot of these same problems, to clear out the liver and stomach and kidneys. And the Russians in Siberia were great fishermen, and they really took raw fish and raw salmon as really a way to solve some of the problems of the immigration to that part of the world. The other thing that's significant is that frostbite becomes a problem. Frostbite becomes a problem, particularly in the face, for those who are newcomers to the area. And alcohol, vodka in particular, is used to treat frostbite. So alcohol not only is there for consumption and for to get drunk, but also is used medicinally. But alcohol is one of the big problems of Siberian society. The positive idea is, of course, that it is used as a medicine for certain things. Dogs are treated with great respect in Siberia. They are used for both security and transport. And the Russians really introduced this. But one of the worst economic problems of the Siberian world are the floods that occur in the spring and really make travel almost impossible. And I know that this is something that I've mentioned before. It's not so much the winter, it's the thawing of the ice and the snow that causes the problems economically and otherwise in Russia, and particularly in the northern parts of European Russia and Siberia. And what then happens is in the springtime, you have so many pools of stagnant water that by the time you have this very short warm season, you end up getting mosquitoes by the bucket load. And this is another reason that so many economic migrants to Siberia end up coming home. So, this is, you know, these are some of the basic considerations of Siberian life that I really think are worth talking about. The Russians really find themselves frustrated in Siberia. They realize that it has a potential of great fertility, but you have the natives that don't care. The natives who would rather starve than work. You have the natives that reject all forms of European education, even technical education concerning farming and you know, how to raise crops efficiently and how to use labor efficiently. And you know, I think a lot of the Russians are just very frustrated in Siberia. And what ends up happening is that the Russians will not hire natives. They will bring in the Chinese, who are very agreeable, very intelligent, and very hardworking. So the Chinese problem in Siberia goes back to this era as well. So I hope I painted some kind of a picture here about what Siberia really is versus the kind of reputation that has developed over the years. So when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about an area that more or less borders Siberia and an area that doesn't get the sort of economic attention that it deserves, and that is the southeastern Russian province of Samara. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the traditions and ways of life of this area. Hang on.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on the Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Okay, everybody. We are back to the Orthodox Nationalists. We are talking about Eastern Russia and Siberia. And we're being a little bit lighthearted here about the topic, because I think that these areas deserve an intelligent treatment. These areas are unknown even among Russia scholars. And it just so happens that because I could read Russian okay, I can read some of the first-hand accounts written in Russian concerning the life of Siberia and the eastern part of European Russia, the province of Samara. And that's what we're going to talk about for the second half of the show, the agrarian world of the eastern part of European Russia. That is to say, to the west of Siberia, the area of Samara. But like Siberia, Samara has a large proportion of merchants, old believers, and religious sectarians, sort of non-official Orthodox people, who live in this area and who make their living here. For the most part, the Russian peasant lives in Samara. He lives in a log house with either one or two rooms. The homes of the Russian peasants in particularly cold areas is very significant, because what you'll see is how they have adapted themselves to the cold weather in order to live a very happy life under very harsh circumstances. And it's a lesson that a lot of us should take seriously. Moss and clay, for the most part, are used in these homes for insulation, and it works very, very well. The doors and windows are very low, and I think you can understand why that's the case. You kind of have to duck when you come into these homes, because the warm air goes to the ceiling, and so the lower the door, the less warm air that goes out into the atmosphere when you open it to come in or go out. So everything has a tendency to be very low to the ground, very squat, and you kind of have to duck in order to get into these places. The other significant thing is that your first floor, your living room floor of the house, is also raised maybe a foot or two above the earth. Because really, when the wood gets in contact with the earth itself, it gets very, very cold. And so to raise it up a little bit, it really warms up the house. And then you could use that little crawl space as storage. So you see, what I find fascinating about this topic and the firsthand accounts that I've been reading over the last week or so, the last couple of weeks, is the level of adaptation. It's very impressive. And I just even wonder if the alcohol is even partially there to keep warm, or at the very least, just not feel the severe cold. The first-hand accounts tend to say that, you can't really generalize about the home. I know so many very biased scholars write that these homes were dirty and no one could live in them and they're not civilized. But people who actually were there and lived there and wrote about it suggest that, there are people who are slobs and there are people who are very clean. And you go into some of these homes, and if you're there long enough, you hardly even remember that you're in the middle of nowhere, that you're in Siberia or Eastern Russia, and that they're very clean and very European and everything else. It also should be noted, and this never shows up in textbooks on Russian history, that both in Samara and even in Siberia, even farther east and farther north, there's a great degree of stress on cleanliness and hygiene. The banya is a steam bath that every Russian village has. But the farther north you get and the farther east you get, the banya is something that people are always... The farther north and east you get, the more they bathe. Partially because of the warmth, partially because of the fact that that they have to work harder for the necessaries of life and this kind of relaxation is something very important to them. They are very clean people physically, and this is something that comes up again and again and again in the primary source literature here. And there's a great sense that cleanliness is something that Christians should do. The natives don't, but we do. And it's almost like the banya, a steam bath, is taken sacramentally. I don't want to exaggerate this, but there's a sense that the steam bath is a second baptism, a third baptism, a fourth baptism, something to cleanse you body and soul. And so the stress on hygiene comes from the church itself. Now, you need, in these areas, you need more land than you would in Ukraine or Hungary or Italy to get the same amount of crop, because you don't have this level of fertility. So, and here's something that I actually started off talking about, the idea of land shortage amongst those in European Russia, and that's what causes some people to immigrate. You have any Russian peasant who lives near state-owned land, which is probably the majority, there's a lot of state-owned land, can rent land from the state for almost no cost. So, particularly in these parts of Russia, where you have far larger plots and really a great level of peasant entrepreneurship, which should be taken seriously by anyone who studies this area. Any time a peasant wants to get ahead, they could rent land from the state for almost no money. So in these areas, and including some areas of European Russia, the land hunger issue is largely mythical, because the peasants are able to rent land from the state for a nominal cost and thereby augment their holdings, while a researcher will only see how much land does a peasant own outright and then conclude that, well, the peasants don't have enough to live on, and they don't bother to look at what land they might rent from the state or from private owners. And particularly out in the eastern part of the country, there really is no great rent. And in certain parts of European Russia, the state is willing to lease land to peasants for, you know, a kopeck or a penny, just for the sake of having somebody till it and somebody make a living off it. And this is another issue, another variable that never comes up in the literature. At the same time, the Russian government at the turn of the century has very high tariffs against its trading competitors, especially Germany, and as a result, that encourages cottage industries. And so the peasants, if they want to augment their income even further, could engage in handicrafts and stuff, you know, at the cottage level. And so in these areas, you have a fairly well-off, entrepreneurial, rational peasant. And had the Russian Empire survived, not gotten involved in World War I and just continued to function, I think you would have seen an increase of immigration to these areas and then a great degree of peasant land holding and a great degree of peasant handicrafts and cottage industries that the government was encouraging. This stuff, for reasons that I think you probably know, never seemed to make it into the textbooks, and yet from an economic point of view are immensely significant. And, you know, some of the stuff, some of the primary literature in Samada also says that the Russian peasant gets a bad rap for drinking, and yet they don't drink very much. They drink, you know, at parties and weddings and things, but Western European males drink far more than Siberian and Samadan Russian males do. The other thing that they say is that the Russian worker is very efficient, but there is one variable, and that's how they're treated. If the Russian worker, if he lets himself out to, say, a local landowner or even the government, if he's treated well and fed well and treated like a man, he will work very hard and very efficiently. The only problem is, if they're ill-treated, they'll do everything in their power to avoid work. Another myth that these people dispel is the lying of the peasant. So many Europeans travel to Russia and say, I can't believe how the Russian worker lies. But the problem is, what they don't understand, is that concepts of private property amongst the Russian peasant worker are not well developed. And so concepts of what is mine and what is yours don't often match Western European standards on that question. They have a communal mentality, not so much an individual mentality, even when they own their own plots and they own their own equipment, etc., etc. So it isn't so much that they lie and that they're terribly immoral, and I've heard so many things from particularly British authors on this question. What they forget is that there's a cultural problem here concerning the nature of private property. If they took that seriously, they'd drop all of these, you know, Tory biases, that they would see that they're dealing with a cultural issue, not a moral issue. And they also tend to see in the primary sources that the Russian peasant, the Russian worker, is a very intelligent person. When they see new technologies that are imported, you know, from, you know, Britain or Germany, they're very inquisitive. If they see that it could serve their communal interests, they will be very interested in what it is. And something else that should be mentioned too: in the province of Samada, a lot of foreign visitors say that the Russian older generation, those men and women who are still alive, who remember serfdom, that these people claim that serfdom was better than this current free economy. And they say it was better because their masters provided everything, provided tools and seed and insurance and education and whatever the peasants needed to make sure that the farm was profitable. Now, in the so-called free market, they got to buy all of these things. And so they're at a terrible disadvantage versus what they were under serfdom. So those elderly people who are left all say, according to these people, that serfdom was better. Something else that they say is that in the 1870s, you had a series of very bad harvests. And what begins to happen is that the landowners of Sumatra and Siberia begin to sell. They begin to sell out because it's not worth farming anymore. You have a lot of bad crops. They run out of their insurance. They just can't do it anymore. And so what begins to happen is that merchants, both Russian, Jewish, and foreign, begin to move into these areas, and they begin to buy up all of this land. And this is something else that a lot of the peasants begin to complain about, that all of these foreigners, including, you know, these urban merchants, come in, you know, have no clue about the agrarian life, and you buy up all of these lands, and the old nobility, of course, disappears. They go to government service, or they move to the cities to become merchants themselves, whatever it is, this old landowning class begins to disappear. So you have several areas where the peasants are able to augment their landholding. And this is something that is really vehemently opposed. So really the majority of literature on the post-emancipation peasant, that even in areas of southern Russia where you have a lot of natives, Kyrgyz and Kazakhs and all of these people, they're mostly nomadic. And yet, as nomads, they own quite a bit of land, often given to them by the Russian government. They have no use for it, and so they lend it out almost at nothing, zero cost, to any Russian peasant who wants to use it. What landowners were left by 1900, even they are not involved in farming anymore, so their land is being let out at minimal cost to Russian farmers. So you have all of this land being rented out at no cost to these peasants who, if you read the Russian or the English or German language publications, are allegedly starving and poor and everything else, forgetting that all of these lease agreements exist at no cost. So, you know, it's one of these myths that really needs to be dealt with. Some of the first-hand accounts also deal with the wages for labor. So if you have peasants who leave the commune, sell their land, and kind of go off looking for work, the labor in these parts of Russia, and even most of European Russia, will always get room and board, no matter where he's hired. They will get food daily, and they will get a room to sleep daily. That's something, of course, American laborers never get. Then a season of work, they get between 10 and 20 rubles, which is a decent sum of money, depending on where they live. However, during the harvest season, the Russian worker will get 2 rubles per day. So whatever shortfalls exist can easily be made up during the harvest season, late summer, early fall. They're getting paid somewhat because there's such a huge demand for labor. Any debts can be paid off at that particular period of time. So what I'm trying to say here is that, contrary to so many myths about the peasant, at this time, even in European Russia, the Russian peasant is doing okay. Whatever the Russian peasant doesn't have, they could easily make up in leasing more land at almost no cost. Or if that's not enough, they could do various cottage industries where the Russian woman is very, spinning and weaving and all this stuff, is very skilled. If that's not enough, they could make up any shortfalls at the level of working at harvest time. And any debts and any, outstanding issues like that can be taken care of at harvest time. So, again, we need to really reconsider the nature of the Russian peasant and Russian worker outside of the cities now. I'm deliberately, circumscribing my area here to the rural areas, which is, 98% of the Russian people who are doing quite well under these circumstances. And one last point I want to make is the agricultural institutes that the Russian government finances from 1900 onward, and that these are, in essence, model farms. They are clean. They are prosperous. There's an intense curriculum for these young men who want to come and really learn the highest levels of agricultural technology and efficiency. And that most of these kids, by the way, are paid by the state, and so they have no tuition. Again, all of this nowhere to be found in the Russian textbooks on Russian history and Russian economics. You know, the Russian government, by the time World War I explodes and destroys all of this stuff, by the way, the Russian government, Russian economy has created such a level of opportunity, has created such a such a level of prosperity for peasants who avoid the cities and avoid the factories. I want to make this crystal clear. We're avoiding cities and factories here. You abstract the cities and factories, and what you see are just endless opportunities that American farmers would kill for in 2009, 2010, that they would kill for. And the Russian government was on the verge of creating the world's wealthiest and most secure peasantry when the regime and the bankers forced World War I on the world to destroy these governments that refused to let the bankers control their lives. And that's really, you know, the conclusion of all of this. I think that similar things were going on in Germany. Similar things were going on in France. I don't have high hopes for the Russian for the Austrian Empire at this time, because they did let the Sassoons and other banking firms, Jewish banking firms, move in. But Russia was on the verge of this huge peasant movement to the east, which would have led to mass prosperity, all the way out to the Far East. And I want to say that, you know, if you're a Sassoon or a Rothschild and you see Russia, the great enemy of at least some of these banking move, and the Russian government is not innocent. They did lend or did receive loans from the Sassoon family and from the Rothschild family. At the very least, Nicholas II realized that he could not give too much to these banking interests and really pissed them off in a lot of what he said. And that he was quite willing to encourage local southern and eastern expansion for the sake of this kind of peasant prosperity. This is where Russia and Germany were before World War I. And that war destroyed everything that these governments worked for, and installed oligarchies, not just in the Soviet Union where they created the Jewish communist oligarchy, but all over Europe. When the royal houses fell, that's what occurred. And so the war destroyed all of these benefits, all of this prosperity, and the huge potential. And on top of which was a very rapidly expanding Russian population that says nothing but health and prosperity for the people who were reproducing like this, and so much land was being laid open for settlement and everything else. Had this continued, Russia would have dominated the globe, and I think they would have dominated the globe in union with the Germans. It would have been a completely different world order, and that's what was lost when World War I exploded in 1914. So that's my show for today. I wish you guys the happiest of New Year's. And I thank you for listening. I thank everybody who cares about this show, whether they like it or whether they're my opponents. I don't care. I appreciate all that you have done for me, all the attention that you have given this show and to me personally. And I want to thank you, and I want to wish you the happiest of New Year's and God's blessings. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
You're tuned into Radio Area.